The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 28, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning. I'm always delayed on the good morning. Good to see all of you this morning. Glad to be here today. So this morning, by the way, I'm Bo Elkington, one of the students here. I've been coming here for a while. I see some new people here today, so I just figured I'd do a brief introduction. So the talk that I prepared for today actually is the kind of convergence of two separate talks that I felt like I had to merge into one at a certain point. And there are two teachers that are pretty profound, actually. So as I was preparing for the talk this morning, I was thinking this maybe could have been better if I kind of dice this into a couple different talks, because it's Wang Po, you know, and Katagiri Roshi, you know. So nevertheless, I just was looking at each of these pieces, and they both were striking in slightly different ways, but also there were some similarities. So I just kind of merged them into one talk today. So we're going to get some little taste of both teachers today. But basically the premise of this talk today is the first moment. So there's a chapter in Katagiri's book here, You Have to Say Something, called The First Moment. And just at face value, the first moment is actually profound. You know, what is the first moment? You know, well, this is our practice, is to be in the first moment. But we often miss this, you know. So the first moment is pure and transparent. There we can see to the bottom of the samsaric world, where there is nothing to analyze and nothing to think about. There we can see what is real. We can see the profound basis of human life, you know. And this runs a little contrary to how we usually understand the world to be. You know, we grow up in our institutions. I'm thinking in academia, schooling, stuff like that, and we have to learn what the world is. We have to learn about the world and figure it out, right? Get the right ideas in order to show up and be successful in the world. Well, this is sort of like just being the first moment, you know. The first moment is direct. It's the wordless experience of perception, the perceptual, you know. We often live in the conceptual, where this is the world of ideas, the world of this and that. And what this is pointing to is the first moment is before we divide the world into self and other, before good and bad, you know. So this is the realization of mind itself, capital M mind. And I'll differentiate that in a little bit here. And so this is unfiltered, uncontrived, very much alive, you know, just being here and now with just this, what is actually happening before we put it into ideas. Zen practice is to live in this first moment. Suzuki referred to this as beginner's mind. There's a very influential book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shunryu Suzuki. Very, very helpful teachings. So what is the samsaric world is the next section here. The first moment is both the creation of samsara, the world of suffering and delusion, and the realization of nirvana. In the first moment, we can take care of the samsaric world, but this is not our usual way. The first moment is very profound, refined, and undefiled. It means your deeds are appropriate to what is actually occurring here and now. In the first moment, you can act very simply, clearly, and straightforwardly. It's not a matter of coming to some decision by way of our calculated mind, nor is it a matter of choice. So very interesting teaching here about the first moment. And so samsara, This is the world of delusion, the world of suffering. And then nirvana, this is like the cessation of delusion, basically, of greed, desire. And so what's interesting here is that samsara and nirvana are not two different places, you know. And this is, he brings it out in this teaching here. So we wake up to delusion. We wake up to the samsaric world. We don't try to escape this. We don't try to push this away, which is very contrary to our usual way. When we encounter suffering, we experience something unpleasant, our usual, MO is to run, to escape, try to change things to be different. And by the way, this isn't negating this. This isn't negating that, taking care of the samsaric world. This is where we wake up. We have to take care of this. And so taking care of the samsaric world, this is right action. This is unwilled action, action from the whole. And the first moment is undefiled, because it is free from ego and it's free from commentary, you know, which are kind of the same thing. The commentary kind of usually comes from the ego, right? Nothing extra is added. And from this openness, from this very moment, from just this, this is where right action will occur very naturally. In the first moment, we don't choose between this or that, you know. It's interesting. I was going to bring this up later in the talk, but so I work as a therapist in the field of addiction and mental health, right? And there's a teaching or education that I try to provide in my individual sessions. And I use a certain book. This is my go-to book, because I think it's a great jumping off place for a lot of mental health and addiction discussion and education. And so the book is Successful Life Skills, Smart Recovery, you know, just basic kind of foundational skills. And so one of the sections in there is about reaction versus response, you know. And the idea here is that we typically react. And this is our immediate reaction, which is oftentimes rooted in, continued suffering. You know, so if we get cut off on the highway, we're going to say some not so helpful things to the other driver, maybe. You know, we're going to get that kind of anger or aggression that comes up, and this is a reaction. And they're trying to lean people more towards response, where it's more measured. Your prefrontal cortex has the opportunity to kick in and it's rational, you know, and we're trying to think about things in a more measured way, which can be helpful. But this first moment is sort of prior to, you know, it's immediate. It's not seeing the world of separation. I shouldn't say not seeing. It's not living out of that confusion that things are separate and apart, you know. So there's like a difference in this action, but I can't really say exactly what it is, you know, but it's coming from an unfettered mind, an unhindered mind, that can see reality as it is before we parse it out into this and that. So there's a koan, which I'm going to try to repeat from my memory, which is not so good usually. But it's Joshu's wash your bowl, you know. So a student shows up at a monastery and asks the teacher, who's Joshu, I just got here. Please give me some guidance. You know, and the teacher says, have you eaten your breakfast? And the student says, yes. And the teacher, Joshu, says, wash your bowl. You know, and it's sort of like what we want is the idea. We want the philosophy or something. When it's direct and immediate, this practice, these teachings actually, which Wang Po is going to bring out here, are always pointing to just this very moment, you know, the here and the now. But as Wang Po pointed out in the section that I was going through, is that thinking or study will not bring us there, you know. And this is going to seem like I'm poo-pooing study, you know, but I'm not actually. It's very helpful, very, very helpful to look at the teaching, study, read, and hear teachings. But Wang Po warns that clinging to teachings, techniques, or philosophies is already missing the way. And so concepts, ideas can be helpful to point to reality, but they're not, if we grasp the ideas, the concepts, as the actual truth, we're missing it. We're missing what's actually being pointed out. These teachings are always directing us to right here, right now, to live fully out of this moment. And so Zen teachings are a finger pointing to the moon. If we get caught up in just the finger, we're going to miss the actual moon, which is a symbol of awakening or enlightenment. I don't know if I'm going to get through all this today. We'll try. So, Zen Master Nansen always said he knew the truth. So a monk asked him, what is it? Are you always there? Are you always in truth? And Nansen answered, I don't know. And so here the student is going to the teacher. The teacher apparently always knows, you know, the truth. And then he's saying, I don't know. I don't know if I'm always there. And so, which is actually very profound. This I don't know means being in the first moment. You know, you can't say what that is. You can't say, if we think of here and now reality, the minute we try to pin that down and get an idea of what that is, it's gone. We've lost it. We've missed the mark. You know, and this is what we always do, is we go with what we think. Instead of what we actually know. Being in this first moment is to see each aspect of everyday life as it is. This is egolessness. It's very simple. But if you say, I'm always in the first moment, that's attachment. That's why Nansen said, I don't know. You know. So I don't know is the mind of the first moment. It's not confusion, it's openness. This is freedom from grasping, free of dualistic thinking or dualistic knowing. And we can't pin this down, as I said. You can't pin down what this is. You can't pin down what this moment is. So Katagiri says, if you say, I'm always in the first moment, that's attachment. Nansen doesn't cling to a self that knows. And this is the same as Wang Po's not using mind to grasp mind. And so just to bring out some of Wang Po's teachings and Steve Hagen's teachings, actually, which is we have a small M mind. And this is the mind that we typically operate from. You know, it's where we see distinction. This is the world of the relative, you know, small M mind. And Wang Po points to capital M mind, which is reality as it is. This is the perceptual. And so we're often missing this. Because we're using small M mind to search for capital M mind, as if these are two different things. You know, we talk about this as if they're two different things, but they're not. You know, but if we use the conceptual to get sort of an idea of what capital M mind or what reality is, we're gonna miss it. And this is our fundamental confusion, is we're lost in delusion, basically, because we're lost in the world of this and that. Is this making sense so far? Hope so. So the monk pressed, if you don't know, how do you know you're there? Nansen replied, you're pretty smart. Just bow and leave. a part of me feels like just leaving this as it is and not really, really giving commentary to this. But that's a pretty, pretty good question. If you don't know, how do you know you're there? You know? So Nansen just says, you're pretty smart. Just go ahead and bow and leave. You know? And what he's doing is he's just pointing the monk back, to just wash your bowl. You know? That's enough. You know, this is teachings are just pointing. And so he's just pointing the student back to here and now. Go ahead and just bow and just go ahead and leave. So the first moment is very profound, refined, and undefiled. It means your deeds are appropriate to what is actually occurring here and now. So instead, I think Wang Po is pointing to this. Instead of getting caught, you know, in the teachings and, you know, trying to figure this out and philosophize about what Zen practice is or what these teachings are pointing to, just wash your bowl, you know. Just go ahead and bow and leave. And this is why meditation practice can be very helpful, because that's what our practice is just being in the first moment over and over and over again. So this mind, capital M mind, is not found anywhere. The first step is to refrain from knowledge-based concepts. This implies that if you were to follow the empirical method to the utmost limit, on reaching that limit, you would still be unable to locate mind. Interesting. You know, I know that I brought this up before. I hate to be repetitive, but my mind goes back to the same stories. So I'm sorry. Some people haven't heard them though. But yeah, I remember going to school, you know, for, you know, college or whatever, and going to Zen practice simultaneously and really trying to understand what these teachings were pointing to. And at a certain point, I just felt like they were canceling each other out. Like I'd go to school, learn all these new ideas and philosophies and stuff, and then I'd come to Zen teachings or practice, and it was like Zen was saying, forget the concepts. Like, that's not going to get you anywhere, you know? So then it was almost like, well, why am I going to school if all of this thinking and these concepts are useless, you know? So it really felt like these two things were at odds with each other, and I had to like pick one or the other, you know, either enter the world of Zen and just have a blank mind for the rest of my life, or go to school and get my mind filled up with all these ideas and concepts. Well, luckily, I mean, that's a kind of a confused way to look at this. And so this is negating the relative. This is negating small M mind. And so when we talk about it in this way, it seems through our dualistic lens that these are not incompatible, you know, and it's never pointing to that. Like these teachings are never dismissing or getting rid of the way appearances look, the way the world appears, you know, the this and that world. But it can seem like that, but that's just a confusion. But what Wang Po is pointing out here is that no matter how much study, no matter how many good ideas you have, it's not going to get you any closer to just this. So the empirical method is a way of investigating the world by gathering observable data, testing ideas, and drawing conclusions based on evidence. This is using mind to search for mind. Sort of. If you're using the ideas and concepts to try to arrive at reality, or capital M mind, it is that way. It's using small M mind to search for mind. It is called the Mahayana mind, mind which is not found inside, outside, or in the middle. Truly, it is not located anywhere. Your true nature has no location. It is not in the brain. It's not behind the eyes. It's not inside anything. As I was looking before this talk today, each of these little passages that I'm going through can be like a whole talk, by the way. I hope you understand that. Like, there's much more to this that could be said. So I feel like I'm glossing over some of this, and so I apologize for that. What you're looking for, it is what you're looking with, you know. And so this is like small M mind searching for capital M mind, which is fine. It's not negating that, you know. It's helpful and useful. Mind is not hidden. It simply is not an object that will form as a concept. So returning to this first moment is our practice. It is not something we can have some idea about. It's something we have to live. So we often think... I like this phrase of first moment, because it's almost begs the question, what is not the first moment? You know, if we're not usually in the first moment, where are we? You know, it's like we're in the second, third, fourth, fifth. You know, it's like something happens, and this is, you know, we're caught in thought. We have to think at length about what happened, and we have to get the right idea, Right. And so we're always like two or three steps behind what's actually occurring in the present moment. And I'm sure all of you have had this experience, where you're doing something and then you get caught and lost in thinking and something jars you, you know, and you come back to the moment and you're like, oh, shoot, I forgot I was just folding laundry or doing whatever. I often find myself like stubbing my toe or doing something ridiculous like that when I'm not, you know, fully present with what's happening. And with my daughter, of course, this comes up for me quite frequently because, to be honest with you, she just turned 5 years old, and I always hoped I was going to have a child. And if I'm honest, I kind of wanted a girl, you know, so I got lucky. And I just spending time with her is just like, it doesn't get any better, right? I mean, this is just like exactly what I want to be doing. But then I'll find myself looking at my phone, or like caught in thinking about the next day or later on that afternoon. I'm not fully present in the moment, you know. And so I try to catch myself and just be with her in whatever is going on. Now, this is difficult when there's complaining or, you know, all the stuff that goes with being a kid happens. But I start try to stay with that, you know, try to stay with what's happening. And so that's kind of our practice, is just coming back to the here and now. And this is still kind of staying in the relative. But I think that's all I can say about it. But returning to this moment is our practice. It is not something we can have some idea about. It's something we have to live. We often live in the you know, moments after the first moment. So I studied for about a year, before I actually sat down to sit meditation, because I didn't quite understand what this was. You know, I was looking at Zen or meditation practice as the ordinary stuff. Like, these are teachings that we have to get the idea of, before, you know, to understand, you know, what is the belief system in Zen, you know, Zen practice. And it took me quite a while to study this before I just realized that, holy crap, this is like, it's just this, you know, and that's what we practice in our meditation, is just sitting with what is this moment, you know. And I remember being in political philosophy class, which I grew up really enjoying philosophy, and here I was in a decent school, and I was getting the opportunity to learn all these different philosophers and teachings, you know, and I was pretty excited about that. But then, and I was also just encountering the teachings of Zen. And I had to write a paper of some sort, and I was walking down the road thinking of all these different things that I was reading about and trying to formulate the idea of what paper I was going to write. And it just occurred to me that, like, what are these philosophers talking about? Like, as many words and as much, you know, lofty ideas that we have about reality, none of it is going to hit the mark. All of it is going to be off in a way. You know, because Zen practice is about just coming to here and now, you know, and it isn't just Zen practice. You know, I don't mean to put this in a box. Like, it's just this reality cannot be put into a conceptual framework. And so no matter how good the philosophy or the idea, it's just this. We don't need to study this, you know, because this is reality, you know, and it's living in the first moment that these teachings are always pointing back to. Sorry, I just went off on a little tangent there, I realize. But anyway, only awake to the one mind, and there is nothing whatever to be attained. This is the real Buddha. So returning to the first moment requires high resolve. This means we have to practice without excuses, just do it. With high resolve, our ego is purified. Selfhood drops away very naturally. So this is about sincerity, in our practice. This is not about perfection, you know, which it looks that way. Like, it, first time you go to like a meditation retreat, when you see all the forms and rituals and stuff like that, it can seem like this is about perfection, you know, like we have to practice rigidly and have the right posture. And it seems sort of rigid, to begin with. That certainly crossed my mind. But it isn't really that way. This is about doing your best. You know, Norm Randolph, teacher here, Used to say that just do your best. Zen practice is about doing your best. So high resolve doesn't mean to force. It's just a steady, wholehearted awareness, attention. All right. So with such a mind, you respond perfectly to whatever situation you are in. It's like driving. You apply the brake before you think, I don't want to hurt that squirrel. You just do it. So this is not about getting the right idea. It's just being with what is occurring. This is an example of natural, unwilled action. Typically, we're thinking about things, and we're splitting the world, and we're coming up with the right idea, and then action comes from that. A Buddha does not act with intention in our typical way that we do. So this is unwilled action. This is prior to separation, without being caught by this and that. So in going back to the source, there's a kind of astonishment. It's not something you can pin down, but it touches your heart. It's like meeting a moose on a country road. When you really face the moose, the whole world is a surprise. And so it's that moment where we come back to just this, the profundity of just this very here and now reality. This present moment is not boring, it's alive, and when we see the moose, we're sort of jarred. It's like, whoa, there's a moose, and reality is like this. It's like by our living in the second, third, fourth moment, we're missing the vitality, the just here now reality. And I'm thinking of like going to work. It's sort of like when you do the same thing over and over again, it gets repetitive and it gets kind of boring, and this is living in the second, third, fourth moment, reality is always fresh. It's always new, And so if we fall into like boredom or malaise or something like that, just occurred to me, I don't really know what malaise means. It seemed like the right word in the moment. But it's like, living in the here and now, fresh, new reality of each moment. So be in the first moment, practice is right here, right now. They do not know that if they put a stop to conceptual thought and forget their anxiety, the Buddha will appear before them. For this mind is the Buddha, and the Buddha is all living beings. That's all I got. Long time. Questions, comments.
I have a comment, but yeah. I can't get my microphone. So I'll just speak a little louder. Yes, when you were giving your talk, the one thing I kind of floated through my head is there was this individual who lives on my block that has some pretty good mental health issues that, poor guy has to kind of handle and so forth. And he has some addiction issues, which is also unfortunate. And I was just thinking about that first moment, that first moment for that individual could be a very different kind of a first moment for another person that doesn't have those same things to work with, right? So I was kind of thinking about how that plays into that lowercase, uppercase mind. Like this person that I just mentioned, I mean, he will be able to look at something and be with it at a place, but I think his mental health conditions are such that he's probably not really seeing what's happening there. So I was just kind of curious with your background as a mental health professional, like, what do you think is going on there? That's kind of interesting.
I think we got to be careful because as soon as we're starting to, because realize that when we're talking about other people, and what they're experiencing, like we're very much off the beam at that point. We're speculating. This is sort of a watch your own mind type of thing. But I kind of get what you're alluding to there. And as I was mentioning in the talk, we don't negate the relative.
Right.
You know, we don't negate the problems. You know, problems that. But these teachings are always pointing to reality, capital R reality, right? So to awakening. So they're trying to get us to help us awaken. And so in the work that I do, that was a big question that I had is how does these teachings or this practice, how does that help or hinder the work that I do as a clinician? You know, at the end of the day, it's sort of like it you can't quantify it. You can't put that into words or you know, package it. And so I don't know what this person's, you know, experience is, you know. Therapy, for whatever reason, talk therapy can be helpful just to you know, get us back on track with our straighten our thinking out,
mm-hmm.
get more helpful thinking, you know. But this is therapy. This is the relative, you know. And so these teachings are you know, kind of getting us to see the fundamental nature of reality, you know. I don't know if that helps or not.
No, and it was really just more of a general question.
Yeah.
I think this gentleman, he's schizophrenic.
Yeah.
So he sees a reality that I don't see,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it just popped into my head during your talk about, wonder what that's like for that individual and how that interplays, you know?
Yeah.
So it was more of just a comment.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot that could be said about that, Andrew, to be honest with you. But we'll talk offline about
okay.
it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this is like in therapy, there are real issues that people have to deal with, you know, and you know, there are certain practices and methods that can be helpful, to alleviate people's suffering with that. But just realize that these teachings are pointing to, you know, this is awakening, you know, so, you know.
I feel like, you know, talking about someone who's got mental health issues, I feel like that is the state for us all. I have a reality. You have a reality. You have a reality. How many billions of people in the world have a reality and none of them are the same? And so I just feel like that's the condition, right? And as much as I think then, of course, then the next thing my head goes to is you're just full of bunk because you're one data point of billions and billions. So try to just do your best to be compassionate and understand what the other person is going to and recognize that you're full of it.
Yeah.
Because you just can't, all you can see is this like tiny, 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 tiny little narrow sliver.
Yeah, for sure. This is a delusion. You know, we live in like this, there's a delusion and it's like being caught and this delusion is pretty, you know, universal. It's like this is our fundamental issue as human beings that we struggle from, or that we suffer from. I don't know how to say it right. Yeah. But with therapy, I just want to be pretty clear about this. Like at a certain point, I did sort of get this idea that, well, everybody just needs to practice Zen. You know, everybody just needs to see what these teachings are pointing to, you know. Well, yeah, but there are also other things that might be happening with a person that we, you know, there needs to be some additional medication or treatment or whatever, because, you know, they're going through some things personally. But also coming back to just this is when we start to speculate about what other people are thinking and going through, you know. Just realize that's part of our confusion too. You know, we're seeing, separation at that point and we're speculating and this is very much in the world of this and that, you know. Yeah. Very hard to talk about this. So I'm sorry if I missed the mark there. Yeah.
I like the idea of just thinking that what I think is just thinking and not right, because then it makes just being in the world that much easier, right? To just embrace one of those people that are driving me crazy or just makes it easier.
Yeah.
I appreciate your talk for that.
Of course. Thank you.
I have a question about the action piece. So you were talking about like with washing the bowl, mm-hmm. you know, that's someone else directing you to do that. But we live in a world where we have free will and we can direct our lives. So I feel like I see the teaching, but then how the second I think about taking my own action, I get caught up in the thinking again, you know, how do you, I guess in a world where someone's not telling you what to do, how do you direct yourself to do the right action, if that makes sense?
Yeah.
That might be a loaded question.
Well, there's just some things that you mentioned, like free will, for example, and there's some ideas there. I think I get what you're kind of alluding to. But this doesn't negate stuff that we have to work. We have to show up in the world. I have a job to do, right? I mentioned I'm a therapist, right? Like I get paid to show up and do that job. Okay. It's not going to go very well if I show up and say, well, the actions that you're telling me to take are not conducive to awakening, so I'm not going to do that. You know what I mean? And so, and not only that, but it's not necessary. Like these don't conflict with each other, you know? So it's like we wake up to the samsaric world. We wake up in the samsaric world. As Katagiri pointed out, samsara and nirvana are not two separate worlds, you know? So we can wait, we can show up, be told by a teacher to wash our bowl, you know? In that moment, that was more of a teaching than a command, you know? It's like the teaching is, don't be worried about all this, you know, speculating ideas that you're thinking about. Just do the thing. Just wash your bowl. Be with that activity, you know. And so I show up for work, you know. I do the best I can to help people, you know, in whatever they're going through. And what I found in my practice is like I can have ideas about what that person is going through. I'm never going to really know, and I can say some things that might be helpful. But I don't ultimately know what's going to be helpful for the other person, you know? But I have a job to do, you know? And in each moment, I can show up and do the best I can do without being caught, you know? So I don't know. That's probably the best I can say about it. But they're not in conflict with each other. You know? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was curious to hear more. I've also experienced this feeling like Zen and philosophy are like at odds with each other. They're telling me to do different things, and yet Zen encompasses everything, so it's not at odds. And I feel like I've settled on philosophy or any kind of writing. It can come from an inspired moment.
Sure.
And that they can kind of fit together in that way. But I was just curious how you came to that more settled place and the relationship between the two, or if there was even something you like read or experienced where they clicked together.
Yeah. Thank you for your question. I think Steve Hagen actually really helped me out with this over the years, because I know Steve's really interested in science, right? And it occurred to me, well, I trust over time that he knows what these teachings are pointing to. He can see reality, right? He can see like what this is, but yet he was still interested in science, you know? It was like, why would you still be interested in getting to the ideas and the concepts through science when you already see what you know the ultimate truth is, you know? And I don't know, through that, that was one piece, I guess, that helped me along the way. But it's just like the relative, you don't negate the relative, you know? So we don't, it's still useful and helpful. The ideas that science, or, you know, the stuff that science comes up with, the therapeutic methods that I'm learning in school are still helpful, you know, in getting me to think about, different ways to help people, you know, so we still, that's all I can say about it, I guess, is like, we don't dismiss the everydayness, the everyday world, you know, the relative world, I should say. So this doesn't go away. And it's still fun, I guess, is the right, a good word, I guess. You know, we can still be interested in topics, you know, even though that those topics may not lead us to the ultimate true reality, you know. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I don't know ultimately how to answer your question, except to say that, you know, it was practice, you know, exploring the teachings and coming back to here and now over and over again helped me see what this is, you know. I think it's profound. What Katagiri brought up is that the samsara and nirvana not being separate, you know. We often get the idea that we have to push away the world of suffering, that once we see delusion, we eradicate it, you know, and we dismiss it. We can just live in a different world, you know. But that's not how it is. You know, we wake up in the midst of delusion, you know. That's what we wake up to. We can see delusion, you know. So it's not that we have to actively get rid of this. I don't know if that was helpful or not, but that's the best I can say at this point. Yeah, of course.
So Michelle Moore asked, is this like saying that being free of the overthinking is the place we aim to be?
Yeah. Well, I think that's pretty good to be free of the overthinking. You know, I know that that's one thing that definitely motivated me to come to these teachings and practice, was that I very much was an overthinker. You know, I remember just laying in bed at night for hours and hours just thinking about what this was. I really was into philosophy and I was taking drugs at the time. So this, you know, that's another part of the equation. But it's like I would just stay awake and just think about, you know, all these things. And I was, it's like intoxicating almost to be involved in that type of overthinking. And it's like, but then, you know, after I sobered up and stuff, I just saw really how much of a hindrance that is, you know, overthinking. And so there was an active kind of step to get rid of the overactive thinking. But how are you going to do that? How are you going to get rid of that overactive thinking? You know, that in itself is just another will to action that perpetuates kind of the problem. You know, Dogen has a teaching that says, think not thinking. How do you think not thinking? Non-thinking, you know. And so this is just opening the hand of thought and realizing that you don't have to actively push away or pull thinking. You don't have to just open the hand of thought and don't be actively engaged with it. This is a practice of awareness. The Buddha summed up his teaching in one word, which was awareness, you know, but it's not an awareness of something particular. It's like a general awareness, which actually is a different thing that I was confused about for a while. But hopefully that helps with the question. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.